Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In documentaries such as The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz, and the West, filmmaker Ken Burns has spent 40 years investigating American history and culture. His films tell the American story not only in terms of victories and major historical flashpoints, but also through the lives of individuals and relationships. Burns's films have been honored with dozens of major awards, including 16 Emmy Awards, 2 Grammy Awards, and 2 Oscar nominations. In September 2008, he was honored by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences with a Lifetime Achievement Award. The National Gallery of Art, in collaboration with the Foundation for Art and Preservation in Embassies, hosted Burns for a conversation with David Rubenstein on April 28, 2019.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Kay Winfeldman. I'm the director of the National Gallery of Art. We're delighted to have you here today, and you are obviously delighted to be here. It felt like a cocktail party in here. Great energy and excitement and enthusiasm. I have been here as the director of the gallery for 2 months now, and I have learned lots of things in my 2 months, but one of the things I have learned is the quality and breadth of our programming here. And this is actually my third lecture today, held here in the auditorium, the trifecta of lectures. And of course, I'm really delighted today because this moment marks our annual presentation coordinated with FAPE, the Foundation for Art and Preservation in Embassies. FAPE is a public-private partnership dedicated to providing permanent works of American art for U.S. embassies worldwide. It contributes to the U.S. Department of State's mission of cultural diplomacy and cross-cultural understanding within the diplomatic community and the international public. All artworks commissioned or placed by FAPE are by American artists and are gifts, representing the incredible generosity of some of the United States' greatest artists and donors. To date, FAPE's donations include permanent works by more than 220 preeminent American artists placed in more than 140 countries. For tonight's discussion, Ken Burns in the American Story, the gallery is honored to host filmmaker Ken Burns and David Rubenstein, co-founder and co-CEO of the Carlyle Group, chairman of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, chairman of the Smithsonian Institution, and in his spare time, he's a trustee of the National Gallery of Art. Mr. Burns has been making documentary films for over 40 years. Since the Academy Award-nominated Brooklyn Bridge in 1981, he has gone on to direct and produce the most acclaimed historical documentaries ever made, including The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz, Frank Lloyd Wright, Huey Long, Mark Twain, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, Jackie Robinson, the Vietnam War, and most recently, the Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science. The late historian Stephen Ambrose said of his films, "More Americans get their history from Ken Burns than any other source." Mr. Burns' films have been honored with dozens of major awards, including 16 Emmy Awards, 2 Grammy Awards, and 2 Oscar nominations. And in September 2008, he was honored by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences with a Lifetime Achievement Award. From FAPE, we'd like to thank Director Jennifer Duncan, Chairman Joe Carroll Lauder, and President Eden Rafshoon. We are very pleased to have them with us today. Thank you so much. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce David Rubenstein to the stage.
So everyone here should know we're very excited at the National Gallery that we were able to lure from the Midwest, Kay Winfeldman. Thank you very much for agreeing to come here. And after 2 months, you're happy, right? Okay. So I just want to mention the other trustees of the National Gallery of Art. There are only five trustees, and I think four are here. So Rick Beinecke is here. Rick is their chairman, or is the president. And their chair is Sharon Rockefeller, who also doubles as the CEO of WETA, our local public broadcasting network, which has the affiliation with Ken from the beginning and really is the principal person, principal entity that sponsors his shows. And also Andrew Saul. Where is Andrew? Andrew is here. Andrew just recovering from hip surgery, but in good shape. Andrew is the nominee to be the head of Social Security. So if you have any concerns about your Social Security, Andrew will be confirmed by the Senate shortly. And any problems you have with Social Security, he can answer them tonight. So we're very honored to have Ken Burns. Ken and I have been friends for quite some time. We've done a number of things together. And tonight what we'll do is we'll have a conversation about how he got into this, how he does the kind of documentaries and films that he does, and talk about some of the legendary ones that we all have seen.
I was just saying I gotta go. I've work to do.
So how does it feel to have your whole life in front of you?
Well, I always like to say God and funding willing, you know.
So how come you've only planned through 2029?
We work in kind of Stalinist 10-year plans, okay. And so it there's a good economy of scale to do that. So really it's 2030, and we sort of go decade by decade and plan it out. And there really are economies that we can take advantage of and sympathies that occur, both obvious. Benjamin Franklin and American Revolution would seem to share some obvious roots. But what often happens is that disparate subjects also suggest a connection to one another. And I think maybe this is what it is. I think American history for me is a vast underground aquifer. And I stick in a well or a straw over here. But what you feel is that you're connecting to the same broad sets of themes.
Okay. So when you were a little boy, where were you growing up? You grew up, your father was an academic?
He was an anthropologist. He taught principally at the University of Delaware from 55 to 63 and the University of Michigan from 63 on. So I sort of was born in Brooklyn and spent the first year in France where he was studying alpine peasants. And Baltimore was in there, but mostly Newark, Delaware, not Newark, Newark, Delaware, and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
So your mother died when you were only 11, and today is the 54th anniversary of her death.
Yeah, I was just texting my brother. I said, you know, 54 years is an awfully long time to be without your mother. She had cancer for the 10 years that preceded it, and so there wasn't a moment growing up that it wasn't there. And I decided almost instantaneously after she had passed away that I wanted to be a filmmaker because I watched my dad cry at a movie. And I hadn't seen him cry, not once when she was sick, not when she died, not at the funeral. And I understood that the film that he saw was called Odd Man Out by Sir Carol Weed, starring James Mason, about the Irish Troubles. Yeah. But it had provided some sort of emotional safe harbor for him that permitted him to express something, though his life had dealt him a pretty bad hand, he had found unable to express anywhere else.
So some people say, or someone has said, that you're trying to, in effect, bring back the dead by all of your history.
I was struggling around my 40th birthday about something, and my late father-in-law was a psychologist. And he said, and I told him that I never seemed to be present on April 28th. It was always approaching and then receding. And he said, and I bet you blew out your candles as a little boy thinking that she was going to come back. And I said, yeah, how'd you know? And he goes, this is the magical thinking of an 11-year-old. And what do you think you do for a living? I said, what do you mean? He goes, you wake the dead. You make Abraham Lincoln and Jackie Robinson come alive. Who do you think you're really trying to wake up?
So when you were growing up, little boy, your mother's deceased at year 11, did you say, I want to be a filmmaker, or how did that come about?
Well, when I saw my father cry at this movie, I said I wanted to make movies, and I wanted to do that. I understood, I mean, there's emotion, which is sentimentality and nostalgia, and it's pretty superficial, but there's deeper emotions that all of us sort of seek in our life. You know, most of our day-to-day is one and one equaling two, but most of what we want is one and one equaling three in our faith, in our art, in this building, in so many other aspects of our life. And I just felt at that moment I'd seen something happen to my dad. That meant, though, David, that I would be John Ford or Alfred Hitchcock or Howard Hawks. But I ended up going to Hampshire College, a brand new school in the...
You could have gone to University of Michigan largely for free.
Yes,
and
for free.
And what did your father say?
It was a kind of good luck. It was Hampshire was then the most expensive college on earth. In the fall of 71, the room, board, and tuition was a staggering $4,730. That was $30 more than Harvard room, board, and tuition. But what it promised was not 40,000 students and a kind of sets of 101 courses, and not to take anything away from the University of Michigan, which is an extraordinary place, but Hampshire was new and experimental. It was sort of, the best way to describe it is it's graduate school at an undergraduate level. So if you knew what you wanted to do or you knew how to look for what you wanted to do, it was great. And I do not recognize the person who went into Hampshire and the person who came out in the spring of 75. I don't. And I started my own company then, and I got my DNA rearranged to do documentaries as well as...
You started your own company called Florentine Films.
Yes.
And you started with people from Hampshire College?
Right, a couple of classmates,
yeah. And where did the name Florentine come from?
So Hampshire College is in Amherst, Massachusetts. It's part of a five-college consortium. One of those colleges is in Smith, which is in Northampton, and a suburb, if that's the right technical term in New England, of Northampton is a town called Florence. And one of our beloved professors there, a still photographer named Elaine Mays, plural, lived there, and we'd visit her often. And so, as a joke, a lark one day in New York, when somebody asked when we were delivering film at the lab, you know, the first name is what's your name, and the second line was always reserved for company, and we didn't have one. And I said, Florentine Films, and we all laughed, and it stuck.
Okay. And where did you get that distinctive hairdo? But your hair was longer when you're in Hampshire.
Yeah, I was just to say, up until Hampshire, it was south of where it is now. So this is a shortcut.
Okay.
And it's just a
so
vestige
Prince
of the
Valiant,
60s.
You go to the barber and say, give me a Prince Valiant, or what did you tell him?
The Prince Valiant thing really hurts deeply, David.
Okay.
I'd like to think of it more as John, Paul, George, and Ringo, kind of from a middle period there.
Okay, but who gave it to you? You still go to that same barber?
Yeah, so I went to this incredibly, I was 21 or 22. I went to this incredibly gorgeous woman who had a haircutter. I hadn't been to a barber shop, let alone a salon, in something like 20 years or 15 years. And so I went, and this woman said, well, let's just do it a little bit at a time. And I said, no, let's just get right. So she ended up at about this, and that's been it. And so she's retired. She's a grandmother now. She's, you know, she's left her business, and I go to her house. And in East Hampton, Massachusetts, even though I live an hour and a half away in a little village in New Hampshire that has fewer people than here in its center village, and she cuts my hair. I'm incredibly loyal.
Okay, so great. So what was your first film? When you started Florentine Films, what was the first film that you did?
The first one was Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, we worked as sort of on a day rate, you know, as a cinematographer for the BBC. I get paid $125 a day, and the assistant cameraman would get $85 a day, and the soundman would get $115, my two partners. And we would travel all over New England and not charge them per diems, and we would work 2 or 3 days a month and pay the rent, and then...
But why the Brooklyn Bridge wouldn't strike one as naturally a subject that people are going to jump to go to the movies to see or to watch television. Why did you pick that topic?
So my best friend then and now is a guy named David Blistein, and he at that point, just out of Amherst College, was a book salesman, and he dropped on my in my apartment one day, David McCullough's The Great Bridge, the epic story of the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, and I literally devoured it in a sitting. And it had reawakened something where my younger brother had read fiction, I had read nonfiction. I would read encyclopedias. I'm a good person to have on your Trivial Pursuits. I do the New York Times crossword puzzle in ink. But I just suddenly opened up, and I said to my partners, this is our first film, and they thought I was crazy. But people would say, an hour on a bridge, maybe 7 minutes? And I go, no, I'm going to have a hard time, as you now discovered, keeping it to an hour. And of course, so, I couldn't do it for an hour to save my life.
So do you talk to David McCullough?
I went to David McCullough first, and he was very sort of skittish. First of all, this child, looked like I was 12, was trying to sell him the Brooklyn Bridge, the topic that he owned.
Right.
And he wasn't buying it. And so neither were any of the hundreds of underwriters I was trying to go to, foundations and corporations in New York. But finally, amassed enough to shoot it, and then I left New York to this little village in New Hampshire where I could live literally for nothing for a few years while I edited it. But it was nominated for an Academy Award, and eventually I was able to get David to give us an interview, and then he'd come up to visit and was so struck by the footage that we took at every time of day and night and every season from every vantage that he said that he would narrate it as well. And so we had written the script, but he was incredibly helpful in not only speaking it. I like to tease him that I gave him his start in motion pictures. But he became a voice for us for the first decade of several of our films.
And where did the expression that you just alluded to, I'm going to sell the Brooklyn Bridge, where did that come from? Did people actually try to sell the Brooklyn Bridge to people?
So this was a huge public work, obviously the greatest engineering accomplishment of the 19th century in America and a great work of art, we tried to argue, and a hell of a good story. But it's also in this sort of melting pot of New York City. And in the second half of the 19th century, the bridge was built between 1869 in 1883, New York had, millions of immigrants passing through, and it became a kind of article of faith, but also kind of a joke that you would take a gullible immigrant and say that this was a public work and it was possible to subscribe to this, and that if you pay me, I will give you this certificate saying you are a part owner of the Brooklyn Bridge. And so it became very much part of the joke, but also part of culture that you sold people the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh, you mean you can't buy it? I thought
it is the epitome of gullibility.
Okay.
Are you trying?
I
talk to me
one.
Afterwards. I think I've still got some stock I can sell you. Yeah.
So now the technique you developed there and that you used in the subsequent films was one that you more or less pioneered, which is to have kind of still shots, music, narration, and a voiceover. Is that the technique you more or less pioneered, or where did you
get it? Yeah, I think we all stand on the shoulders. You can't say that you start from zero, but I think what we tried to do was engage that person who was at first initially interested in feature films and say that every still photograph represented what to a feature film director would be a master shot that would have in it a wide, a medium, a close shot, an extreme close shot, a tilt, a pan, a reveal, and inserts of details. And so I treated a still photograph not as this object that you held at arm's length, but something that was alive, a representation of a moment that had a past and would have a future. So it wasn't just what it looked like, what stories you could tell within it, but what it sounded like. Were those troops tramping? Were the guns firing? Was the bat cracking? And then if you added that complex sound effect and had not just a third-person narrator, but a first-person voices giving you the style of articulation of the past in love letters and journals and newspaper reports, you might be able to wake the dead. You might have that moment where you fell. I mean, one of the best compliments I've ever had was at the premiere at the Brooklyn Museum. We set up folding chairs, and I brought my own screen, and they had an AV cart, and I brought my own projector, and we projected it. And the first question afterwards was a woman who said, "Where did you get the footage of the building of the Brooklyn Bridge?" And I said, "It was built before motion pictures. There's no footage." She goes, "No, I mean when they brought the stones up to the bridge and lifted it up to the towers, and they put it on those caissons and things like that." I said, "Ma'am, those were still photographs." And she goes, "No, they weren't." And I thought, you know what? Be quiet. You won. I said, okay. She thought they were moving.
So after the Brooklyn Bridge, you did a few others, the Shakers, Huey Long, and Statue of Liberty. But then you came up with the idea of doing the Civil War. Now, that was pretty epic. Where did you get the money for it? Where did you get the idea for it? And did people tell you were crazy at the beginning?
Everyone... I got the idea for it because the Civil War was the determining factor in every single one of the films that I had done so far. The Brooklyn Bridge was finally built by a man named Washington Roebling, the son of the designer who died in the first months, who got his practical training as a bridge builder during the Civil War. And if it hadn't been for the Civil War, he would not have promoted industrially this new metal called steel, which would have made it impossible. You couldn't build an iron Brooklyn Bridge. The Shakers declined precipitously after the Civil War, not because of just general social or economic changes, but in a country that the question of the soul's survival, which is their question, wasn't being asked in the same way that it had before. Huey Long came from a dirt poor North Louisiana parish that refused to secede from the Confederacy. They thought the owning of slaves was a rich man's cause, and so it became a hotbed of radicalism and populism and even socialism that would eventually spawn Huey Long. The Statue of Liberty was originally intended as a gift from the French to Mrs. Lincoln to commemorate her husband's ultimate sacrifice, though the Union was survived. And of course, Congress's most important moment was when there were two Congresses, one in Montgomery, Alabama, later Richmond, Virginia, and obviously here in Washington, D.C. So the Civil War was swirling, and I finished reading Killer Angels by Michael Shara one day, Christmas Day of 1984, and I turned to my dad. I was visiting him in Michigan. I said, I know what my next film is. And he said, what is it? And I said, the Civil War. And he goes, oh, what part? And I said, all of it. And he looked at me, and he just shook his head and walked out of the room like, my idiot son. And that was the first of many kind of like, what? It's not going to be an hour? It's going to be what?
Well, how many hours was it?
Well, we originally intended 5 1-hour hours each year of the war, 61 through 65. And then it just got away from us. And the story demanded a deeper dive. And so it ended up being 9 episodes and nearly 12 hours long.
Where did you get the money for that?
So the money came principally from the National Endowment for the Humanities, from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from General Motors, which for 22 years was our sole corporate underwriter. Now it's Bank of America since 2006 and through to 2029, and other sort of a handful of other places, the Arthur Fining Davis Foundations and the MacArthur Foundation.
Ultimately, it cost how much?
It cost, for me, my part of it is 3.4, and if Sharon Rockefeller, who's been our producing partner since well before the Civil War, since Huey Long, it was probably 3.5 or 3.6.
The total cost was?
3.6.
Okay, and when you put it on, how many years did it take you to do it?
5.5 years, from the time I said that to my dad to when it was broadcast.
And when you were at the end of 5.5 years, before it was broadcast, were you worried that what might not work?
I knew that it was a good film, and I felt it was a good film, and that's where documentary filmmakers were. I mean, at that point, I'd had 2 Oscar nominations for Brooklyn Bridge, the first, and Statue of Liberty. I lived comfortably, I thought, in New Hampshire, and I thought this is, I had reached the apotheosis of what one could do. And I went to the press tour in Los Angeles in the July of 1990, and the reviewer said, this is terrific, but no one's going to watch it. This is an age of MTV commercials and fast cutting, and it's just not going to be watched. And anyway, Stephen Bochco has this new police singing thing called Cop Rocks, and no one's going to watch your thing.
Right. So were you stunned when the reaction was so positive the first week and so?
We were more than stunned. I remember being in a bar at the Warwick Hotel in Midtown Manhattan where these CBS executives were drinking, and they were swearing at me.
Okay.
Because all of the numbers were skewed. In some cities, we beat all 3 of the national networks, and that had never happened before.
So in putting that together, you obviously had a terrific musical accompaniment there. What was the secret to the music? How did you put
the music together? Secret to the music is not a secret, and I've shared this for the 40 years I've been doing this, but no one does it the way we do it. We record our music before we begin editing. Music is the fastest art form there is. It's what Wynton Marsalis calls the art of the invisible. 2 notes months, and it is working on you. Why is it that film music is always added at the end, like icing, to amplify emotions you hope are there, rather than be baked in from the beginning? So I went through a songbook of hymns from the period, of popular songs from the period, obviously from military songs, North and South. I had them played 40 or 50 different ways, each one of those 40 or 50 songs. And then we had what we call musical beds, the battle cry of freedom. Dun, 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 dun. We'd have 40 different versions of that and 40 different versions of Dixie or Hail Columbia or the battle hymn of the Republic, whatever it was. And then one of my session musicians had written this beautiful, a Jewish guy from the Bronx, had written this beautiful Scotch-Irish lament just a few years before I started, called Ashokan Farewell, which I realized could be a kind of musical bridge. It sounds like it was written back then, and yet it had an immediacy. And I promise you today, David, that song has been played at a funeral or a memorial service or a wedding or a renewal of vows. And it has been for the 29 years since the Civil War has been out, this just incredible piece of music that I think bridged the present and the past.
One of the emotional highlights of it was a letter that was written by a soldier that did not live, who did not live to see his wife. Where did you get the idea for that?
Well, we had always wanted to tell a bottom-up as well as top-down history. That's the kind of history that we like, and I think it's the best kind of history because it gives so-called ordinary people, and what you find out in life, and particularly in war, is that there are no ordinary people, that their story is as important as the boldface names that our history is normally distracted by. And those boldface names are really important. We did not neglect Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis, Ulysses S. Grant, and Robert E. Lee. But we felt it was important to know Sam Watkins of Company H of the Tennessee Volunteers and to know Elisha Hunt Rhodes from the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers. In any case, I begged our 24 advisors, some of them, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning historians, to send us that documentary first-person material, and they rarely did. And one day, I got a letter from Don Fehrenbacher, who was teaching at the University of Illinois, and he just sent me this thing, and I ripped it over. I said, "Oh, here's finally a letter." And I started reading it, and by the time I was done, everyone, my brother, was in tears. And he said, "Should we try to put it into Manassas, which it takes place just before Manassas, or first Battle of Bull Run, the first major principal engagement of the Civil War after Sumter?" And I said, "No, put it at the end of Episode One, when we're past that and we're looking back and understanding from both sides' points of view that this was no longer going to be, as people would joke, a 90-day war." Washingtonians came out with picnic baskets to watch the Union romp of the Southerners. And for a while that was happening, and then it didn't happen. They rallied around a group of soldiers led by Stonewall Jackson. "Look, there's Jackson standing like a stone wall." And the Union army retreated, and they got caught up with the visiting picnickers, and it was a rout. And so at the very end of the episode, you realize, uh-oh. And I played that letter. It is from a man named Sullivan Ballou to his wife, Sarah, back in Smithfield, Rhode Island. And he talks about love, which is a four-letter word for most of us and difficult to talk about. But he talks about love of country. He talks about love of government, not a fashionable thing. He talks about love of cause. He talks about love of family. He talks about love of wife and of children and of an enduring love that he felt that he shared with her. And it is, you know, every man wishes he could write these letters, that kind of letter to the woman he loves. Every woman wishes her man had the ability to write that kind of generous thought to them. And I think it's just, I used to carry it around in my wallet and read it for 15 years until the piece of paper just disintegrated in my pocket.
When the Civil War was completed, then you were very famous then. I mean, you were not as famous before, but everybody then who knew Ken Burns was. So somebody in your situation could have said, "Now I'm going to Hollywood, and I'm going to make Steven Spielberg or George Lucas kind of movies that are going to make me really, really rich." Because I assume you did not become a billionaire out of the Civil War.
I did not.
And why did you not go to?
I was courted. I really like the idea of PBS, public broadcasting, we know, and the S is not system, it's service, right? And I liked the fact that every film that I've put out with PBS, with WETA, has been the director's cut. And I know that even A-list director friends that I have in Hollywood complain, oh, that we didn't have enough money to do this, or I couldn't use this person, or they wouldn't let me use that. And I've never had that excuse. I mean, if you don't like any one of these films, it's all my fault. And I will completely take responsibility. And I never thought in all of the things that have come over the transom in the 29 years since the Civil War, including just recently where someone had seen the entire, an early, press screener of the 8 episodes and 16 and a half hours of country music. And he said, this is so great. I can go to a streaming service and I can get you 9 figures for your back catalog and for all the things you're doing. And I just said, you know what? It's so tempting, but I don't want to do that because there is no other place on the dial, that ages me, where the Vietnam War, just to take one of the films, but I would say it apply to all of them, could be made. I could go and say with my reputation to an Amazon or a Hulu, and I don't want to, unfairly, diss them, and say I need $31 million to do a history of the Vietnam War. They'd give that to me. But they wouldn't give me 10 and a half years to do it, which is how long it took. And so our film represents still, a year and a half after its broadcast, the aggregation of the latest scholarship across 30 or 40 different categories.
So today you are not a fabulously wealthy person, but you have no regrets because you're doing things you love doing.
Exactly. And I think we measure, as you know, as well as I do, we measure riches in so many different ways. Right. And that it's super important for me to live in New Hampshire, to have a relationship with my children, to be, who I am and have the kind of co-work. And the other thing is, I don't make these alone. I am not the one-man band with the oompa and the cymbals and the drum and all of that. There are many, many talented people who deserve to be here, sitting here with me, and I'm just like the conductor of a really good orchestra.
But you don't require them to have the same kind of haircut or thing like that?
No, it's they're liberated from that. A few do, but I don't think it's in any emulation. It just may be a cultural thing.
One of the other epic movies that you've done, documentaries, is on Vietnam. You alluded to that. How long did that take and how much did that cost?
10 and a half years, $31 million. And again, it would not have taken place anything else. We went into it with the idea that this was a controversial subject, but that it didn't have to be the film itself controversial, that it was possible to tolerate contradiction and undertow, as we've done in all the films, and to permit you to lift up the rug and sweep out some of the dirt and not paint or sugarcoat history as we too often do, and at the same time listen to all the different voices. And so for the first time, Americans were hearing what ordinary North Vietnamese grunts were thinking. They understood what a Viet Cong guerrilla was thinking. They understood what our erstwhile allies, the South Vietnamese, who we blame for a lot of things, were doing, and they were not as bad and as cowardly as we paint them. In fact, the bravest person I've ever met is a South Vietnamese Marine who is barely 5 feet tall. And when you see in episode 3, the Battle of Binh Gia, you'll know what I mean and what he went through. And then the whole spectrum of American opinion, from deserters and draft dodgers to heroic Marines like Carl Melantis, going up the hill, even when it's like Custer.
So in Vietnam War, your conclusion was that the United States public was misled?
Oh, I don't have to make that conclusion. It was made by its own leaders, beginning with Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower and John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson and Richard Nixon, and to a much, much lesser extent, Gerald Ford. The papers reveal it, the back channel conversations, the tapes, most importantly. So I had a luxury in the film in which I didn't need to build as much false work and scaffolding, right, that the evidence was just there to just say. I mean, for example, it's very important for me in that film to tell you, David, that when Nixon did something good, it was important to say that it was good. It wasn't just good politics, it was good policy, like ending the draft. But when he did something that wasn't so good, I didn't have to say anything because there was a tape. I just could play the tape.
Now, the Civil War, could that have been prevented in any way?
Well, this is a huge philosophical, moral, ethical, an almost existential question. Many people thought that slavery would die out in a generation or a generation and a half. But you have to understand, 4 million Americans in 1861 were owned by other Americans, and they did not have a voice in that. And so it's very easy in the abstract, as we do with the Civil War because of the distance, to presume that it'd be okay to go on for another generation and a half. But I would ask you how long you'd like to do that, and you wouldn't say that, or even a decade, or even a year, or even a month, or a week, probably not even a day. You might say, put these irons on and go, holy Toledo, this is a piece of iron. I've got a set of leg irons on my desk in New Hampshire that I pick up. The weight is stunning to begin with, but they're forged, manufactured machines that have only one purpose. In the United States, which was founded on the ideal that all men are created equal, yet, oops, asterisk, the guy who wrote that owned more than 200 human beings, that you would have these things that actually kept, by the time of the Civil War, 4 million people in bondage. So maybe it could not have come a moment too soon. And we're still wrestling, of course, with the aftermath of Civil War. At the end of the film, Shelby Foote is celebrated for his presence in the film, justifiably. But the next most present person is Barbara Fields, a scholar from Columbia University. The last thing she said back in 1988, when we've interviewed her for a film that came out in 1990, is that the Civil War is still going on. It's still going on and regrettably can still be lost.
So if you could interview any American who's ever lived, who would you interview?
Abraham Lincoln.
And would you conclude that he is the greatest American?
He's certainly the greatest president. You know what? Let me qualify that. I think you have to say, when you argue about baseball, whether it's Willie Mays or it's Mickey Mantle or it's Hank Aaron or whomever is the best player, you say, except Babe Ruth. And I think you have to say, except George Washington, because we just don't have a country without him. But once you've set in motion a country, and we're working on the revolution now, and daily we're reminded about his indispensability, Washington's. The best president, without a doubt, is Abraham Lincoln.
If you could interview any woman in American history, who would you?
Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I think she is the best writer. She's in the top five American writers of speeches, and she was married with kids, so it was the unmarried Susan B. Anthony that went out and gave the speeches, and so got a little bit more of the glory and the dollar. But it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton who is really, I won't say the brains behind the outfit, but this great articulator. And if you just Google the solitude of self speech and read this beautiful thing she did at the end of her life, it's poetic beyond belief.
Now, despite your fame and how wonderful your documentaries are and your films, money doesn't just come out of the sky, right?
No.
So how do you raise money, and what is the Better Angel Society?
So for up until the Better Angel Society, we raised it from three different sources. The corporate source, General Motors, for 22 years, then for the last 13, Bank of America, and extending for another 10, about a third. And then corporates a third, then big institutional foundations a third, and then what I'll call governmental. PBS isn't governmental money, but their money, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. After the 08 meltdown, I realized that I needed to add where a good deal of the wealth in America was to individuals and small private family foundations. And so I created an organization called the Better Angels Society, and its CEO and its executive director are here, Amy Berg and Courtney Chapin. And
there they are.
And what we've been able to do is sort of fill in the gap of the tightening and the shrinking of the sources, corporate and foundation and governmental, that took place after the recession, and supplement it with extraordinarily generous individuals, including yourself, that help us not only make the programs, which we are dependent upon, and help us do a lot of ancillary educational things that promote civics education and civil discourse in the United States. And it's called the Better Angels after the last line of Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural, when he was appealing unsuccessfully to the better angels of our collective North and South
nature. So are you trying to raise any money for anything that you have in the works now?
Just about everything that you saw there is open for bidding, and I'll take.
Okay, and talk about country music. That's going to be on in September.
Yes, and it was something that I can't believe it took me this long to do. It is all the subjects are chosen because something hits me in the gut, and it feels like it's American history firing on all cylinders. this is that and more so. I mean, the thing that we understand is that we can work really hard on a film, and all we are storytellers. I don't want to sort of stretch it much more than that. And we focus on trying to master very complex across a lot of time that we demand of our audience, and a lot of stories and a lot of characters and a lot of contradictory aspects to it. And when we lift our heads up after 10 and a half years with Vietnam or 8 years in country music, or any film, including The Brooklyn Bridge, we are stunned by the way in which it mirrors the present. People say history repeats itself, or we're condemned to repeat what we don't remember. That's not true. Human nature never changes. Ecclesiastes said it. What has been done will be done again. What has been will be again. There's nothing new under the sun. And so what you see is the continuation of themes. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And whenever we lift up out of a project, we see those rhymes and are stunned. And so, I think you and I've talked about this before, that when I was out in the summer of 2017, you remember we had a new administration in for 7-8 months. And I would start off and I would say, what if I told you I'd been working for 10 and a half years about a film about mass demonstrations taking place across the country against the current administration, about a White House in disarray, obsessed with leaks, about a president certain that the press was making up stories about him, lying, about huge, big document drops of stolen classified material into the public sphere that destabilized the political equation, about asymmetrical warfare that confounded the mighty might of the United States military, and accusations that a political party reached out to a foreign power during the time of a national election to affect that election, you'd say I'd been talking about what had been going on for the last year or 16 months in the country. But in fact, all of those things were true of Vietnam when we began work in December of 2006. And they were true when we locked the picture. We still had work to do, but locked it editorially in December of 2015, a month before the Iowa caucuses. So, and I could take that and do that for every single film I've worked on.
So you've gotten a lot of awards. There's few awards that are available to you that you haven't gotten. You've gotten every award probably. So why did you decide to take the time to come and receive the award from FAPE? You could have spent your time in New Hampshire. Why did you decide to come down and accept this award?
You know, I am interested in what the United States exports, and not just in terms of the material things that might influence an economic balance of trade. I'm interested in the ideas. Lincoln, in his address to Congress in 1862, what we would call the State of the Union speech, said, "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation." And then he also said, you know, "But our case is new, and we need to think anew and act anew, and then we'll save our country," which by the end, he said, was the last best hope of earth. It implied a kind of exceptionalism that we too often take for granted and don't live up to, or at least don't demand of ourselves the rigorous self-criticism that being the best always requires. But I think embedded in our stories, our American stories, are universal truths that represent the best balance of trade in our favor of anything I know. And so that the idea that in our embassies, the place in which, like almost chemical bonding, the receptors of us connect with the receptors of others, we have the opportunity to exchange the best thing we have, which is our ideals.
Okay.
Period.
Well, Ken, thank you very much. We're out of time. Thank you for coming, accepting this award.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.